Mark Sarvis is the...
Write that.
But you do understand, the interview does indeed involve Mark Sarvis.
Sentence is too long. Strike two words. Stick with nouns, please.
Oh, I get it. Segundo's dead, and you're trying to find a new conceit. Look, the novel is Harry revised, and this is your cutesy little way of referring
to the... Strike the last sentence.
Can you just give me a chance? I mean, ever heard of a lovely little grammatical term called stet?
Strike post.
Oh, just roll the interview. Okay, I'm here with Mark Sarvis, who is most recently, actually recently, it's your first book, the author of Harry revised. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
First off, I wanted to actually ask you about the names in this book. You have... Harry Rent being the name of your lead character, but it reminded me very much, and I was sort of thinking of your Star Trek post, of Arthur Dent. And also you have, of course, the Velt family. Anna is from that. So how did these names come about? Harry Rent is a rather unusual name.
Well, it's funny. I never made the Arthur Dent connection, but it's not entirely inappropriate. They're both kind of feckless comic characters. I was just reading something about this, and I don't recall where, but I'm always wary of... Oh, in fact, James Wood, in How Fiction Works, he talks about characters who have names that are sort of put to, you know, metaphoric use and required to carry more weight. And I'm always suspicious of names that are a little too on the nose. But as I was trying to come up with a name for this character, I really thought about the nature of Harry being really a divided sensibility, divided consciousness. And so the idea of Rent, as in a fabric rent or something torn apart. I thought that was subtle enough that it wouldn't scream its significance. And then I just began, I liked the sort of the melody of Harry Rent. And Anna's last name, that's a bit more pretentious. I'm almost hesitant to talk about it. But it's actually German for the world.
Yes.
And I really sort of wanted this sense of his world, her being, or his need to have her as his world, the moments in his life where she, in fact, was his world, and then that got transformed over time. So there's one or two other really unforgivable little names like that. The one I wince at now is Dr. Couteau, the surgeon, which is, you know, is French for knife. And if I
was thinking Jean Cocteau.
Much more elegant.
Like
I prefer
that. You're sort of bleeding like a poet there or something.
I think if I had that one, if I had one more pass at the galleys, I'd probably change that, but...
Well, what of, for example, Goldberg and the fucktard references throughout the book? Did you get the man's sanction, or?
Well, you know, it's Todd's mission to spread the use of fucktard far and wide, and I note him in the acknowledgments, and the joke back and forth was Todd actually wanted me to say, Todd Goldberg, who made me what I am today, and I was tempted to do that, and then I was afraid people wouldn't realize that I was being ironic, and suddenly I was very afraid of being thought of as molded in Todd's image, so
which
I
is
let
why you
one
made
go.
Him an old lady, essentially.
That's
in this.
Right, but he, yes, fucktard is it has taken root and it must be disseminated widely. So I've done my bit and I'm moving on. There will be no more fucktards in my books.
Oh, okay, so. Okay. I mean, the OED, you could be quoted in that if it actually makes it in there.
I'm sure I wouldn't be the original usage, but I would certainly be an early official usage. So
and
that would be
Elliot nice. Was that Stephen Elliot by chance?
No, Elliot was a guy I went to junior high school with who used to, like, terrorize me. And he was actually a tough Elliot. Mm. And he was a bad kid, and I think he actually ended up doing some juvenile time or something like that. But it was sort of my revenge on the Elliot of my youth to make him this feckless late-night phone caller, so...
Really? I was going to ask you about that. How much of it was invention and how much of it was based on this personal experience? That's very interesting that you mentioned that.
The phone call is actually pure invention. It's one of those serendipitous moments that every writer has, because in my original vision of the novel, what I had really planned was that at the very end of the book, Harry would receive a phone call from someone who hadn't spoken to them for months and months and hadn't known Anna had died, Anna being Harry's wife, and this person's reaction to her death would be so heartfelt and emotional, it would really sort of shame Harry and be a trigger to Harry's own grieving. But one of the other little conceits that I wrote into the book is because the real central theme is about change and how we change. I wanted something to change in each chapter. And so there was the chapter where Harry changes his phone number.
Yeah.
And I realized once I did that, I could no longer have this ending because he's changed the phone number with no forwarding message. And so I started to think, well, gosh, what can I do with that? And then I got this idea out of the blue of somebody calling that old number looking for the previous owner of that number and getting Harry.
And
so Elliot was pure invention.
And this whole changing the phone number is interesting because it's a bit hypocritical in light of the fact that here he is violating the privacy of his assistant's browser cache and trying to sort of dig up dirt on various people. I mean, maybe you can talk about the level of hypocrisy in this. And the other thing I wanted to mention in relation to this is, was deconstructing Harry in your mind in naming these characters?
No, but it's funny. Harry is a name with sort of a great, seems like a literary pedigree. You know, everyone's talking about Harry Angstrom, obviously.
Yeah.
But the other thing... really where Harry, the name, came from, the first name. I had written a screenplay, and it was a comedy set in about an American going over to Britain trying to get a title. And the American's character, my original draft, was named Harry, but they thought that was too British a name, and so we changed it. But I'd liked Harry, I'd liked spending the time with him, and so I recovered the title, the name, and I used it.
There's a decidedly hirsute quality about...
A little bit, yes. And we won't talk about personal influences there. But it's interesting. The changing of the phone number to me wasn't so much a notion of privacy to me. It was really more about severing ties and reinventing himself. And, you know, on this book, Harry is on a continual quest to make himself over as something and somebody new. And he has this realization, if you recall, that the only people calling on that number anyway are Anna's friends. It's his old life. And he wants to be separated from it. So I don't know that he's seeking privacy per se, but it's that he's now wanting to make over his life on his own terms. But yeah, Harry is all full of inconsistencies. And I think that's, I was having a conversation with a friend today about human nature, I think, is toward inconsistency. I think we sort of unfairly pillory people when they're inconsistent. I hate it when politicians are accused of flip-flopping, because to me, someone whose point of view evolves over time is a much more interesting person than someone who clings unvaryingly to a dogma. And so I would hope that Harry is inconsistent. It's that, to quote James Wood quoting Henry James, it's that notion of characters free to contradict themselves on the page, and I hope that Harry is like that. So,
in light of this societal concern, there's something I wanted to ask you about. The way that Harry is doing good towards people often involves essentially spending a lot of money to solve their problems. And this is interesting to me because he also relates to people in this vocational capacity, in the sense that the women in his life are met through sort of service capacities and all this. I'm wondering if this kind of larger quality was something you were sort of dwelling upon in dealing with the way that Harry, often hypocritically, helps others and does good.
Again, not dwelling on so much, but certainly aware of one of the things that that I thought of while I was writing this book was had to do with notions of class. And, you know, American novels, American fiction don't generally concern themselves with class. In fact, Leila Lalami, who runs Moorish Girl, wrote a great essay on that subject, I think for Powell's a few years ago, about sort of the lack of class as a theme in American fiction. And it's not a central theme of the book, but as you recall, there are moments where, you know, Molly essentially calls him on this position that he's utilizing and taking advantage of, in essence, his power, whether it's economic or, you know, patriarchal, if we want to get into identity politics. And I think it's enough for Harry to be thinking about those things, to note them. He still does them, but he's got the dawning awareness that something is telling him that it's not quite right. And I think that that's all that we can really hope for, at least in one book. I'm not a big believer in answering all the questions. And, you know, Harry has to have somewhere to go after you set the book down. And I think we see in this book the beginning of his journey toward realizing those ideas, how he relates to people, what, you know, the financial comfort of his life signifies, all those things down the line. And maybe that's the stuff of a future Harry novel. Who knows?
Oh, Harry too. Well, actually, in light of this class consciousness, I wanted to actually remark on the fact that you have many clerks occupying this book, and you often describe them. For example, there's the man who is apparently reading David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, who is not looked upon favorably from your narration. And then, of course, there is a later clerk who you describe as this portly, bespectacled kid who's 19. And this is interesting to me because this notion of having third-person voice like this, and you're kind of wrestling with an issue here because you're not telling it in first-person voice from Harry's perspective, and yet Harry occupies the entirety of the novel. And there is this dwelling upon judgment based off of the third-person voice. Or how close did you want to go in writing this book? And maybe you can talk about this relationship between Harry's perspective and looking at it from afar.
Well, I think that you know, it's definitely in third person, but it is really close third person.
Yeah.
And at times, you know, goes into the free and direct where we're in his thoughts, even though we're not, you know, wrapped in quotation marks, things like that. You know, interesting, if what you're asking suggests that I have some sort of dim view of the service class.
No, but I'm not suggesting that it reflects you, but you're sort of reflecting what Harry is sort of seeing, because he's in this position of wealth and affluence,
right,
and he can essentially solve problems like this. So it becomes this interesting sort of moral issue, because it's not from his perspective, and yet it is.
Right. Well, I think what ends up happening is, you know, when as any writer will tell you, you're writing a book and you have your major characters and your minor characters. And you know, there are often characters who will come through the book, in essence, to fill a role. They fill a task you need them to do. I needed Harry in a bookstore. I needed him to interact with a clerk while he was there. You then think, how can I make these minor characters memorable? The fact is that you finished the book, and we're here talking about a character who's got a page and a half in the book, and that tells me I did something right in making him fix in your memory. Now,
David Foster Wallace does actually trigger off a thing
now,
with me.
Did I have a little fun at his expense? Sure. One thing I can tell you, and there's the description of that clerk is actually drawn from a young man who sat right beside me when David Foster Wallace read at the Hammer Museum. And he had the pierced eyebrows, he wore the ski cap, and he was writing in this notebook, and he was just writing the tiniest, like, incredibly neat, almost jeweled pencil handwriting, lines and lines and lines. And there was something a little terrifyingly compulsive about him, but I was fascinated by him. And so when it came time, you know, I mean, I'm evasive enough to call the writer, I think, a fashionably three-named novelist or something like that.
Yes, yes.
But yes, certainly the people who know my site and know my bugaboos will know exactly who I'm referring to. But in the end, it was really, I think, just about making a character who was a little memorable, had his little moment upon the stage, and then wandered off. I'm not sure who the other clerk you are speaking of. Maybe it's
when
they
he's
go shopping
buying the
with
shoes.
Lucille.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I don't remember him being portly. I remember him being bespectacled, but
you,
I don't recall.
I can drag it out
call
here.
Call you on it. But,
No. He's described as definitely weight.
I think it is not a stretch for anyone to say that, you know, the service sectors in this country are.
But not everyone
are,
is like
are
that.
Lacking.
But see, I mention this because this obsession on weight, because there's a portion where he is speculating upon the kid, and he thinks that he's going to be this fat slob, and he turns out to be, as you described, lean and angelic. So
exactly.
I'm asking about how this relates to Harry's perspective.
Well, I think part of that, honestly, is a little bit of his infection by his wife and her standards and her family, because as you recall, they're very obsessed with that sort of thing. And Harry himself is a guy who's let himself go a little bit. He's not obsessed with this. So I think I also wanted to show a little bit about how those values, when they're really forced on us by others, can infect us without our fully realizing it. So I think that, you know, and again, I think it would have been in a way, because Lucille, this boy's mother, is an overweight woman.
Yeah.
It would have almost been a cliche to have made him an overweight child. So I wanted to sort of play against that expectation as well, and then see how Harry would process that expectation, because he's not the most enlightened chicken in the coop, you know, and he definitely, so that was part of wanting to see how he would adapt to the unexpected.
Gotcha. Well, Anna is actually a palindrome. Was that intentional?
No. And the thing that really troubled me with Anna was that I was, I think, a year and a half into writing this book when John Banville's novel The Sea came out. And in The Sea, the main character, Max, is mourning the death of his wife, Anna. And I thought, oh my God, everyone's going to think this is my Banville homage. And it was really not. It was just, I was looking for a simple and elegant name. And Anna just sort of floated into my mind. That was a more instinctive choice than anything else.
And yet there's inarguably an elegant variation in this. I have to ask you about a dancing St. Elmo's fire of the groin.
Okay.
Now, this is really just all you had to do was say that it was an erection.
But I mean, you see, you mentioned that and you sent me a text message. And
I asked five people about this and they said, what the fuck?
But, and look, first of all, this is a book of nearly 300 pages. Not every single metaphor is going to sale. There will be those
that
fall to the ground.
It's definitely memorable, that's for sure.
But to my mind, but I was not describing an erection. I didn't intend to. And the fact that, you know, that you thought that that's what I meant argues that I didn't do my job well. Because what I was really hoping to describe, and this is perhaps not the stuff of a normal Segundo podcast, and I hope my wife isn't listening to this, is that weird sort of tingling pre-erotic moment that, you know, announces the onset of of an erection. That's sort of where you're beginning to feel that surge, that electricity, that wave, but you haven't actually flown the flag up the pole yet. And that's what I meant that to be. If I wanted to say erection or boner or some other...
But the fact that it's ambiguous is very interesting, because then it leaves... I mean, this could be discussed endlessly in book clubs across the country.
And I think it's better that way.
It's the phrase that definitely I can't get out of my mind and makes me look at you in a sort of cockeyed way, so to speak.
I welcome anything that challenges people's received notions of me.
Yeah, got you. I wanted to go back to this issue of the fact that Harry appears in every single moment of this book. Were you resistant to the idea of deploying side characters in separate moments? Because this is a very interesting thing to me. In fact, I actually kind of have an issue sometimes with books that sort of shift from perspective and kind of abandon certain characters. In this case, like I said, it's very much a third-person voice, but it's also vicarious first-person voice. Were you resistant to side characters?
No, it's a very close third-person. And it's funny, I didn't really think about it that way. You know, Harry was kind of a gift to me in that I got the idea for the book, and the moment I got the idea, I saw how the story would be told. And when I look at the first file in my Microsoft Word document, and I sketched out how this would unfold, that is substantially the book I wrote, and not because I clung unyieldingly to my outline, because I'd even forgotten that that file existed. But it was a story that suggested its own telling. And as I sat down and I thought about what I needed to do in this chapter and what I needed to do in the next scene, Harry was just in all of those moments. It's not where I thought, oh, I should really break away, but I don't want to leave him. I was going along with Harry. He took me everywhere, and no other possibilities really presented themselves. It would have been a different novel. Now, that there is, you know, in another dimension, another edition of Harry Revised that tells the story that way and is, I think, an equally valid way of telling the story and equally interesting. It's just not the way the story came to me, you know, and I'm very much a creature of instinct. When I write, I mean, I do some outlining. That is the holdover of my screenwriting experience. But I let the book go where it needs to go, and it never left Harry. He was too much fun. I didn't want to be away from him.
Do outlines get in the way of these more protracted chapters? Because these are generally 20-page chapters in this.
No, they don't, because the outlines aren't really scene-by-scene outlines. This is what has to happen in chapter one. This is what has to happen in chapter two. And I'd written about the first three or four chapters, and I noticed that in the typescript, each one was exactly 18 pages. And somehow I became obsessed now that they all must be 18 pages long or I'm doing something wrong, and I couldn't have a chapter really veer in one direction or the other. And I finally decided, get over yourself, and I made myself write a 21-page chapter just to break that sense, that hold over myself. But it really is, the chapters are all roughly the same length. I don't know how or why that happened. I think some of it's arbitrary in terms of where chapter break occurs, because I moved the breaks around a little bit. They could have occurred in other places. But I think it makes for a nice, smooth, sort of consistent reading experience.
Did you need sort of sustained episodes to allow the readers to get used to Harry, that this was the only real way to get inside? And also, maybe we can talk about the flashback structure, where you sort of do this alternate chapters in which you go into Harry's past and you start to kind of get a sense of how he ticks and why he's in this dilemma.
I was actually sitting in a workshop when I was trying to figure out the specifics of that, and I came up with the idea of the flashbacks occur every third chapter, consistently throughout the book.
Yes.
But they go from most current to oldest, so they're in reverse chronological order, and I didn't do that just to be, ooh, look at me, I'm going to be different. I did it because the conceit of the story for me was that Harry should have trouble in the immediate wake of Anna's death visualizing her, remembering their lives together, and I wanted who Anna was to come into clearer focus through the flashbacks as we went back to really the root of why they fell in love and why they were together. So it can be a little challenging for some readers, because it really leaves you till fairly long in the book to answer the question, well, why are they even together? Why do they belong together? And you have to be willing to take that journey to find out. But you'll find in the early flashbacks, we see Anna partially from behind, from the side, and she doesn't really come into full view until that penultimate flashback when they're in Greenwich with her parents, and then the last chapter, which is their courtship and falling in love. And then that was where I had to sort of fight in terms of how I place the chapters of current day action around them, because I really wanted to preserve this every third chapter so that the reader would have something that would tell them, now you're in a flashback. And we actually ended up using that repeat line of 7 years into the marriage, 5 years into the marriage, which wasn't there originally, but we just felt we needed to be, because it's all in present tense.
Yeah.
We wanted to not confuse the reader and alert them at the outset, you're now in a flashback.
There's also something really disturbing about the way this structure, because you have, for example, the ring, which we open up. He's lost the ring, and without giving it away, we then see that, well, he's kind of an inveterate ring loser throughout the book, which sort of suggests that this guy really is kind of hopeless in terms of changing or revising. So what of this, and why did the ring appeal to you best as the way to express this?
It's funny, you know, I had this comment with a friend of mine about how once a writer finishes the book, it's not the writers anymore. It's the readers. And it's so interesting, and I love conversations like this where I hear your reaction, because, for example, until this moment sitting here, I didn't realize that I have two important set pieces with the ring. I have the first flashback when he loses his ring, and then I have the flashback when he's proposing Tana, and I forgot about that. So honestly, I don't know that there was a conscious method there, but it is sort of a neat little bit of symmetry, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's more, I don't want to suggest that Harry is hopeless, because I don't think he's hopeless, but he's got a lot of work to do. He's got an uphill battle, and I think that, you know, what I'd said to my agent and editors is, as we were working on this, is, look, I don't necessarily expect everyone to like Harry, and I don't even care if you like him. James Wood talks very eloquently about this need to have sympathetic characters, and he sort of goes after Amazon.
Who cares about sympathetic as long as they're interesting,
for requiring their characters to be likable. But I said, but I want you to at least be rooting for Harry to do the right thing. That's the emotional moment that I want. And I think you do that with him. And I think at the end of the book, he does enough of the right thing that you have a sense that he's going to be okay after this. And that's really sort of the journey that we take him on. But no, that's a very interesting observation about the ring. I want to hear more about what patterns you've located in my book, because you're probably more cognizant of them than I am.
Well, again, you're obsessed with the word meme, so you know.
Yeah, well, you know,
we all have
crutch words. I was emailing with David Levitt, who I've gotten to know through my blog, and we were talking that, you know, and it made me feel good when he admitted even he has crutch words. And I, in an early draft, I found that I began so many sentences with the word clearly. And then I thought, well, wait, if it's actually clear, you don't need to say clearly. And I, with the red pen, I removed almost every iteration of clearly from the manuscript. But there are still words. I'm sure that there are one or two others. I use regards in the place of looks quite a lot. I don't know why. I'm, you know, pretentious, elegant variation, but I like that word. And there are other words like that. So I know I can recall two uses of mean. I want to go back now, and that's M-I-E-N for you Segundo listeners. I need to go back and do a global search now and see how many of those there are.
Well, maybe we can talk about this notion of repeating yourself. I mean, it seems to me that with the ring thing I just mentioned, you weren't aware of this, and I'm wondering if you get so involved in writing a novel that you just can't care about whether you're repeating yourself, whether it's a crutch word or whether it's a symbol.
Well, I think, you know, look, that's why, while you're writing, you know, there's so much to hold in your head. Invariably, there will be inconsistencies. There will be, you know, our good friend Dan Wickett found a screaming, horrendous typo in this thing that I can't believe is in there. It's a real, and it's a fact-confusing typo. So I had to send an email to Bloomsbury, please fix this right away. But, you know, as you go through the revision process and you have agents and editors and people who read, they tend to alert you to sort of the most grotesque repetitions. I don't know that, for example, that the notion of the ring, I don't know that that purely constitutes a repetition, because that really can be viewed as a symmetrical, an opening and a closing.
But purely a subconscious.
Subconscious, but just because they're subconscious doesn't mean the writer doesn't know. I had this conversation with John Banville, and we were talking about The Untouchable, which is one of my favorite books of his. I don't know if you've read that one. Glorious. That, you know, is one of his best. But in the book, the main character, Victor Maskell, has been outed, scandalous. He's been a Russian spy, and he's sort of giving his last testament, and he's basically preparing to do away with himself. And the whole book really is about the conflict of, you know, his intellectual self, his mind, over his heart, his wishes, his desires. He's a closeted homosexual. And in the last paragraph of the book, he's got the, you know, the gun in front of him, and he asks himself, head or heart? And I just thought, what a brilliant encapsulation of the entire book right there. And I asked him about it, and he looked at me sort of blankly, and he said, oh no, I didn't mean it that way at all. It just, you know, it just came up. And I don't believe he's being disingenuous, but I do believe that when you get in that place that we just discussed, when you were living this book and you have it in your head, something takes over. And so although I consciously may not have been aware of that, somewhere subconsciously I'm sure I had a sense of that. We all have, you know, you're a writer, you have it as well, that alarm that sort of alerts you when you know you're doing something not quite right, but you're not sure why, or that weird feeling of satisfaction when you kind of feel like you've nailed it, but you're not quite sure why either. So
you alluded earlier, in fact, and this kind of relates to this topic, to using sort of idiosyncratic verbs. There's one moment I outlined here where you say, his face and neck bark an angry pink. And so you use bark instead of, say, resemble or look. Why are you attracted to verbs that are a little bit different in the way that usually people communicate?
That's a very good question. I think, look, you know, as a reader of my blog, certainly, that the writers I revere most are the writers who really work deeply with language. John Banville, Michael Ondaatje, people who really, they almost are more poets than novelists, almost. And I think, as a reader, I love reading a sentence where a word is used in an unusual way, but it's a way that seems apt. I think language should be challenged. It should be stretched. That's where, for me, it's not just about telling a story. I have a clear sense of narrative. That's important to me. I'm not one of those literary fiction writers who thinks plot is a dirty word. But it has to be coupled with language that's interesting to me. And like, I'd forgotten the bark, but as I'm hearing it, I think that actually works kind of nicely. That doesn't feel overdone. That feels like it's
four letters,
it's
you know. Right,
yes, that's right. You don't have to go fetch a dictionary like you do with John Banville sometimes to see what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, it's been instilled by me a little bit by Martin Amis, who I don't like so much as a novelist, but I really respect as a critic. His notions of cliche and his notions of tired phrases and sentences and pushing oneself to write sentences that are original, that are new, that are fresh. And you risk overdoing that, and every sentence cannot be a sculpted jewel, because it's like eating an entire meal of foie gras. But it's worth aspiring to, and as a reader, it interests me, so that's what I end up doing as a writer.
In fact, we should probably talk about the style. I haven't even broached this with you. I know that you read The Great Gatsby every year. And
yes, although I haven't started it yet for this year, January is ticking away, so I need to pick it up and get with it.
Well, it was evident that obviously you're a Fitzgerald junkie, because I was reading this going, oh my god, he's using adverbs in that 1920s way, very much like Fitzgerald does, with a sort of French farce kind of quality. How did this particular style develop, or was it just a matter of plunging into, was it Harry's voice that kind of encouraged the style?
These are wonderfully interesting questions, Ed. It's funny, a novelist of note who, purely for discretion's sake, has to remain nameless, was talking about my book very positively to some international publishers, and said, I didn't think they wrote books that way anymore, which I really took to be a great compliment. When I interviewed Andrew Sean Greer, when he had put out Confessions of Max Tivoli, I said to him at the time, I think before the interview began, that I thought that the most subversive thing a contemporary novelist could do today would be to write a resolutely old-fashioned novel.
Yes.
And that was absolutely not my stated mission with Harry, but I wanted it. You know, there is a lot that harkens back to something like The Count of Monte Cristo, which is a key plot device, and it informs the sensibility of the book a little bit, structurally, you know, in terms of chapter endings, the chapter openings, you know, in which our hero. I really wanted to sort of alert the readers that we're in a book that pays tribute to a certain kind of, you know, older fiction, but I hope grafts a modern sensibility onto it. I wanted to take the best of the old and bring it to it some of what I think is the best of the new. So yes, there is definitely an old-fashioned streak, which is a little bit of a reflection of what I like and what I like to read. But it's also a sense of, as I said, I want people to go back and look at books like The Count of Monte Cristo and realize, you know, what great contributions they've made to our ideas of storytelling today, which I think can get lost in the landscape of literary fiction right now.
But to me, this style actually really helps a lot of areas. Like, for example, that chapter in the hotel room. I think it gives something that could have ordinarily been entirely creepy if it had been written in a contemporary fashion, this kind of strange edge that actually is rather funny and like I said, evocative of a French farce. So I'm wondering, were you aware of things like this? Did you deliberately broach creepier material like either masturbation or hookers or urination? Just to be clear, this is an entirely highbrow book.
Of course. Yeah, no, it's funny because, you know, the people who know me personally, my wife talks about this all the time, I'm actually like a terribly squeamish person in conversation. I don't like to talk about those kinds of things. I've got this weird sense of propriety. So I guess it all comes out in the book. But I was taking a workshop with a novelist friend of mine named Leslie Schwartz, and one of the things she really encouraged me to do was to push the discomfort. And there's the scene, in fact, where when I describe Harry looking through the window and seeing Lucille naked.
Yeah.
And she talked about how uncomfortable that made her, but that she liked that, and she thought that's what fiction should do. It should push you to where you're uncomfortable. So there's a lot of things I wrote about that made me a bit uncomfortable while I was writing them, but I thought part of it also was this weird sadistic streak to say, I'm going to put Harry in as low as I can take him and in as much trouble and as much jeopardy, because, again, I think that makes it interesting from the perspective of conflict, from the perspective of character growth. So I really kind of threw the kitchen sink at Harry, and,
yeah,
and you know, I feel bad for him, except I knew I was going to see him to a safe place in the end, and I knew he could take it. You know, in terms of French farce, old-style books, the fact is that any one of us, as writers and as readers, we are the total of our influences. We read these things, we assimilate them, they become part of who we are, and I don't know that it's always that conscious. I was just up in San Francisco at a panel from the NBCC, and it all spoke about California literature and West Coast literature, and both David Yulin and Andy Greer agreed that, and I wholly agree with them, that the whole notion of California literature, West Coast literature, is absurd.
Yeah.
There are good books, and there are bad books.
I agree.
And you know, yeah, nobody calls the new Jonathan Safran Foer novel a New York novel. Those are novels, and the rest of us are California novels. But what Andy said is, he said, you know, the writer doesn't think about any of that stuff. The writer thinks about writing the next sentence. How do I get this guy out of the room? How do I get him into the room? And when all was said and done, that's really all I was thinking about with Harry. I knew the emotional markers I wanted to carry him to. I knew he had to get there organically. And I just thought, how do I get him there? How low do I have to take him? And then how high up do I bring him? And then whatever, you know, our own inner demons and sicknesses and perversities that we bring to the actual execution, that is, you know, the leper's stew that each one of us has for a brain.
But to me, that's very interesting, this style not only creating this mood, but also, as we discover late in the book, masking this really deep internal pain that Harry's going through. And it seems to me that, yes, we're talking about subconscious symmetry, but clearly there had to be something conscious in terms of how the style was masking this great trauma that he was feeling.
Well, there, I mean, there you nail it. Dead on the head. Dead on the head. Because for me, what I was always trying to convey in the book was, I want this sense of this thing that's too terrible for Harry to look at. And so all the shenanigans that he goes through, whether it's, you know, the business with Lucille, the business with Molly, it's really for him to avoid dealing with this thing that lies beneath. And by the end of the book, it's just reached a critical mass, and he can put it off no longer. So yes, you nailed exactly what I was hoping to do, and I'm glad you read it that way. And that's just sort of planning and plotting and pacing and looking at what feels right and moving lots of things around. And, you know, in the original version of the book that we sold to Bloomsbury, there was really a sense of a rush to the end. The last chapters were a little bit different because it became this narrative pell-mell, you know, got to get to the end and wrap up all the stories. And that emotional sense that you're talking about wasn't there as present as it is in this version now.
That's interesting, in this whole rush to meet the end, because I felt that some of the empathy is like, whoa, where did this come from? You know, near the end of the book, all of a sudden we're just getting this gushing forth of what his actions really sort of entail. And we haven't even talked about Max, his older friend. Maybe we can sort of, which, since you were talking about Andrew Sean Greer, I was wondering, Max Tivoli, or?
No, you know, I always thought if I had a dog, I'd name him Max. I love the name Max. And then my wife brought Maggie, our dog, along, so I didn't get to christen her. But no, Max is just always a name that's resonated with me. And some things are very consciously chosen. Other things are really flip a coin, subconscious, arbitrary, and the naming of Max was one of them.
Yeah. In terms of the modern edge that you wanted to push in relation to the sort of more classical 1920s tone of this, I note that there's a lot of italics in terms of Harry's thought process, as well as throughout the book. There's also crossed out items. Were there specific sort of limits that you set in terms of where you can go stylistically, how modern you could go and how classical you could go, or was it largely more of an organic process?
It was really instinctive. I mean, the book that really got me on my way with Harry was, you know, was oddly enough, was White Teeth, which I'm, you know, everybody knows I'm a big admirer of White Teeth. And when I read it, what I really admired so much about the book, which is a little bit of a mess at the end, but I admired Zadie Smith's fearlessness with language, that she just put her head down and went for it. And there was something very liberating about that. And I think I wrote the first chapter of Harry flush out of white teeth. So that egg version, which exists no longer, was nothing more than a naked Zadie Smith ripoff. But over time, I was able to take that notion of freedom, temper it, make it my own. And so she definitely informs probably the more modern edges of the book. But it wasn't, like I said, I really work very instinctively from that perspective. Putting it all together, reading, does it work, getting it back, feeling, does it feel emotionally balanced? Because, like I said, I get very suspicious of, you know, revelation all dropped in one scene or things that are unearned. Earned epiphany, earned emotional growth, that's all very important to me. And I'm lucky enough to have a small workshop of very smart writers who got to read Harry, you know, chapter by chapter as I was writing it. And they sort of kept me on the track and let me know, this is going to be a problem, you need to go back and make sure you establish this more. So that really, that sense of what I had to establish early so that it felt justified later is something I got through a workshop of people who I trust.
In terms of this influence of authors you read, and of course you're probably reading a lot more than most writers, I'm wondering if there's a certain kind of danger in terms of how it affects your voice. If, for example, the first chapter is an unapologetic Zadie Smith homage, then I'm wondering if other chapters face this kind of predicament and as you're developing this particular style.
And, you know, it's funny. It's going to be much more of a danger with my second book, which I've begun, because I'm very influenced right now by The Untouchable, Banville, which I mentioned earlier, and The Book of Evidence, just sort of structurally. But I realize with Banville, there's such a huge danger because I'm such a fan of my doing a Banville pastiche, an imitation, and it would be nakedly apparent to everyone, and I can't do that. So of all the authors not present in this first novel, I think Banville's voice is most absent.
Yeah.
But I think that, again, it's back to that question of influence. We all absorb the writers who influence us, and it's the difference, you know, with Zadie Smith, I had just come off White Teeth and I started writing. So it hadn't had enough time yet to really become something innate and ingrained in my voice. It was still very much on the surface. Once I knew who Harry was, and as we say again, that it is such a close third person, the tone then became clearly apparent to me what the tone needed to be, and maintaining that was less of a challenge because I knew, okay, I can't go on a Banvillian flight of poetics in this paragraph as much, yeah, as I'd like to, because that doesn't fit the moment any longer.
It's interesting, too, that there are a lot of one-sentence paragraphs for the dialogue, and maybe we can talk about how your screenwriting experience factored into this. And I also wanted to ask how your blogging went into this, because I saw a lot of similarities in terms of the comic tone in this and some of your longer posts at the Elegant Variation, like, for example, your total Christopher Hitchens is just should be stopped. Dude, that whole thing, it reminded me, I'm like, well, this is very actually close to the sort of tone I'm reading in Harry Revised.
You know, we all have a voice. I mean, any writer, I think, acknowledges you have a voice, it's distinctive, I have a voice, it's distinctive. When I gave the first draft to Layla, who was one of my early readers, and she sent me back a note and she said that she loved it, that it was full of the trademark Mark Sarvis humor. And that stopped me because I wasn't aware that I had a trademark Mark Sarvis humor. But you're right, there's a sensibility that comes through on the blog. And because the blog is an even more unguarded view into my thoughts, it makes a certain amount of sense that there would be similarities in tone. You know, it is largely the way I write. But that's definitely an interesting part of seeing how people respond to this. The humor is there, but as I said, people have also been expecting it would be more of a Banville kind of a book, more of a very deeply literary, plotless meander. And my agent was thrilled when he got the book to find that it wasn't, that it was in fact had a plot, had a modicum of commercial appeal that he thought he might be able to sell.
Well, I was likewise surprised by the rather creepy humor, because I'm like thinking this, oh wow, this is a little bit unexpected, and maybe I want to ask you if the humor in this was a way for you to kind of broach this comic side that you were sort of unaware of or vaguely aware of.
You know, I had a writing teacher years ago at UCLA. He was a lovely, lovely man. I've written about him on my blog, Stephen Corbin, who died some years ago. But he said to me, I had written something for the class, and it was a comic piece. And he said, if you can be funny, be funny. Write your book and make it funny. It'll be better for your chances. And so it's not so much that I sat down so calculatingly to say, I will write a comedy. But when I got this notion for this story of Harry, and it started coming out in that way, in the shadow of White Teeth, sitting down, it came out as a comedy. And as I mentioned, Leslie Schwartz earlier, she's the one who really encouraged me to go where it's uncomfortable, to go where it's dark. So, you know, I probably pushed the creepiness a little bit, even past my own comfort zone, in a response to that. But I think it ends up being effective. I think, you know, contrasts, extremes, they make for vivid, memorable moments in fiction. But they're not so extreme that they're implausible behavior. I don't think Harry does anything that's really implausible. He's kind of screwed up. And, you know, I make that clear from the beginning, but I'm hoping that we'll feel something toward him. Not contempt and disgust and pity, because then you're gone, but a curiosity, an interest. I think there are glimmers of something better within him that would like to come out. And I think that's what a reader will connect with and hope to see come to the light of day.
I've discussed this issue with other writers who are, quote, funny writers. The idea of basically writing a comic narrative and essentially doing it through routine and process and only just discovering afterwards where it's funny. Is this kind of an issue for you, or was this an issue for you when writing Harry Revised, that you were more concerned with the idea of the narrative, and how did you tap into a place where you knew there were funny moments, but you weren't quite sure of where they were, but you knew that it also worked with the narrative?
That's a very good question, and you know, part of that comes back to some of my experiences in screenwriting, because what I've learned as a screenwriter is to mistrust the joke.
Yeah.
If you're relying on the joke for your laughs, it's not very deep. What you really try to do is set up funny situations and see where they take you. And so I tried to create these situations that created a broader potential for humor, and I would know soon enough as I started writing if I was right or if I was not, because if that potential was there, it would emerge organically in the writing. And as you know from The Elegant Variation, sometimes my tendency is to push a little too hard to get that last laugh out, and we rolled some of that back in the editing to say, okay, this is the joke. You don't need this second grace note and this third grace note. And so part of that sense of comedy also, I think, is, you know, less is more, editing, knowing when enough is enough. But really, ultimately, that comedy comes out of the situation, comes out of the paces that you set these characters to. And I was comfortable enough with my own instinct of, just again, what makes me laugh. Because, again, as a writer, you know, you really can't worry about an audience. You have to write the kind of thing you'd be interested in reading. And I trusted that I would know. I've written enough comedy screenplays that I would know when it was working and when it wasn't. But my next book's not going to be a comedy, and I've already warned my agent. It's not going to be funny. It's going to be very, very serious. You know, it'll probably be the book that everyone thought Harry would be. So,
well, speaking of comedy, I want to ask you about the spinning chapter, because this seemed to me, and I said this to you, I sent this an email to you, but it seemed almost kind of a comic take of the squash chapter from Ian McEwan's Saturday, and I was wondering if there's any sort of credence to this theory of mine.
Not at all, but I love it. I love the parallel. The truth is that I was writing that sequence of events, and what the chapter is really about is it's one of the early moments when Harry really begins to determine that his wife is ashamed of him, embarrassed by him. It's one of the first times we see that in the book. And I was talking to my friend Jim Ruland, who you know, who's a wonderful writer, and he was very helpful as I was working through this book writing it, and I mentioned that I was thinking about setting a chapter in a spin studio, but it made me uncomfortable because I spin, as people who read my blog know. I do it regularly. I felt it was so identified with me that people would take that and start to read the book as autobiographical and think it was me, and he just looked at me and said, "You must write that." Because he could just tell the comic potential. He just said, just, you must write it. And I trust Jim enough, and that was enough for me. And I went off and I wrote it. And, you know, I have immortalized my cycling coach. He hasn't seen the chapter yet. But I'm sure when he does, he will be both amused, flattered, and
is his name close to Gearchick?
It's Gary Kobat.
Oh, very close.
But,
Gear.
And he might even be a little irritated, I'm not sure, but I'm banking that he will be flattered. So,
in fact, you became a hardcore cyclist, as I think, midway through the book, because I noticed in the latter portion of the book there are more sort of references to cycling as it went along.
Absolutely, and again, that was another case where, with the whole business of the courtship during the Tour de France, again, I spoke to Jim about it, and I said, is this going to be too much? I've got the spinning, now I've got the Tour de France, and he encouraged me to use it. Yes, in fact, Harry took me 6 months longer to write than it should have, because in the middle of writing, I basically took 6 months off to train for that big bike race in Tucson, which was 100 miles, and so I wasn't really writing during that period. And then when I was done with the race, Jim said, okay, you're done being a cyclist, get back to your book. So yes, that definitely, that material entered my consciousness, the landscape, and worked its way into the book.
Well, in going back to what I was mentioning before about the weight of the Clerks in relation to Harry and his own concern for being out of shape, which he doesn't, which, I mean, and I keep saying he doesn't, because the actual narration seems like it's from him, although it's from third person, but it dwells not so much on the fact that he's purportedly this chunky guy.
He's a little soft in the middle. It's not much worse than that, but he's got a bit of a belly, for sure.
But the fact that you don't dwell so much on his weight, but rather him thinking about his weight, to me is quite interesting, and maybe you can talk about this interior monologue. Also, and we haven't even talked about the fact that he's a radiologist, and here he is X-raying things and capable of seeing through things but not being able to see through reality. So with those,
I'm glad you picked up on that.
Several things in mind.
And you know, on a lot of these, there won't be clear answers, clear-cut answers. You know, I'm a big fan of ambiguity, and I'm not one of those writers. For example, I can't tell you Harry's whole biography. I don't really know those things about him, and I've been asked questions about the book where I honestly answer, I don't know, and I think that's okay. What I can say is, you know, Harry's views on weight to me were really meant to sort of show him channeling Anna's sensibilities and how those got forced upon him, because clearly, you know, he's sort of let himself go a little bit. It's not that big a deal to him. And it becomes something, and I think I wanted to show that lingering influence, not to the good, that came from Anna and her own, but you even see from Anna, it comes from her parents. So that one can always trace back, there's a root cause behind the root cause of whatever it is that we think and feel. And that's what I was thinking about there.
But it's interesting also in light of his hostility to Mr. Tour de France, the previous boyfriend of Anna, whose name I forget momentarily.
Jeremy.
That seems to sort of tie into this general theme of how he's very concerned about his weight. And it's just very underneath the surface there.
And you know, like, it may well all be there. To me, Jeremy was more sort of this, represented someone of Anna's world. Her class shares her sensibilities, even down to weight and fitness, that they sort of speak the same language and thus feed on Harry's insecurities. I mean, we've all been around people like that who have really, you know, cranked up our insecurities, and I think that's really how I intended the role I intended Jeremy to play. But, you know, maybe Harry has a secret deep down weight issue. I don't know. There are traces of it that are there, and I think that,
well, he's,
it's
about
all fair
40,
game.
So, you know,
mid-40s.
It would
mid-40s.
Make sense that he would be having this dilemma going on.
As I can tell you firsthand, that's when the body starts to go. So, you know, you have to pay more attention when you get to a certain age if you want to remain fit. But I think it's, like I said, it's mostly about tying back to Anna and her influences on him.
Well, Mark, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great.